exactly see the point in sticking around. He suspected they had said as much as they were going to say on the subject of the merger. He looked to the door to the patient's room. "Doesn't get many visitors," Karen had said. He took a deep breath and let it out. He opened the door and quietly stepped inside. The woman was fast asleep, but her breathing was shallow and troubled. Slowly, uncertainly, he lowered himself into the chair by her bed. "Do the work," Claire had said. So, was this the work? Ben didn't mind unloading tractor trailers or hauling pallets of lumber or even sweeping warehouse floors. But sitting in a hospital room, the smells of medicine and bleach and death all around him, sitting with someone he didn't even know and who almost certainly didn't know he was there, this was not something he'd signed up for. But here he was. He reached over and took the woman's papery hand in his. She didn't stir. There was no sound but the tick-whir, tick-whir of the machinery, giving the woman oxygen and monitoring her vital signs. As he sat, holding Phoebe in accounting's grandmother's hand, Ben replayed his conversation with Karen. "Where do you stand, Ben? And what do you stand for?" That was easy. God, family, country, and the Martin Group, right? That's what he supposed he stood for. But at that moment, for some reason Ben couldn't identify, the words felt more like abstractions than a vivid, personal truth. Tick, whir. Tick, whir. What precisely did he stand for? He didn't think he'd ever asked himself that question.
Chapter 10. An Imprint on the Soul. Ben arrived at the busy cafe a good 2 hours later than he had on the previous days, sure that his lunch companions would be long gone. And indeed, as he approached the corner table, Claire was nowhere to be seen. Much to his surprise, though, Aunt Elle was there, having tea and evidently waiting for him. "Claire said she is so sorry, but she couldn't wait any longer," said Aunt Elle. Ben apologized for being so late, and explained briefly about his morning at the hospital, about the mother and child in critical care. In fact, although he didn't go into these details with Aunt Elle, he had spent quite a while in the grandmother's room in oncology, thinking. Finally, he had left to go hunt Karen down and had found her in the waiting room in neonatal, where they sat together waiting for any news. Ben hastily ordered a salad, and Aunt Elle ordered another pot of hot water for her tea. Just as the waiter turned to head back to the kitchen with their order, Ben had an afterthought, and asked if he could also have a hot cup of coffee, fresh, delicious coffee, right away. He was eager to get the sense memory of that hospital out of his nostrils and taste buds. "How is your week going?" Aunt Elle inquired politely. "Your project?" The waiter set a cup of hot coffee in front of Ben, and he sipped gratefully at the exquisite brew. He could hardly believe how good it tasted. "Well," he thought about how to answer her question. "The day we first met, you asked me, what did I have to offer them?" Aunt Elle nodded. "When the week began, I was pretty clear I knew the answer to that question. Now I'm not so sure." She regarded him thoughtfully. "Years ago," she said, "when I was in a position where I was often called upon to speak before large audiences, my father gave me some advice. 'L,' he said, 'never let them see you sweat. If people sense you're not in control, they'll eat you for lunch. When you get up there to give your talk, it's all right to be nervous. Just don't let it show.'" Aunt Elle let out a brief, dismissive snort. "Usually my father's advice was brilliant. In this instance, it was abysmal. I did what he said, or tried to, anyway, just once. It was horrendous. Oh, I stood up there on the dais and put on a good show, pretending to be omniscient and invincible. My talk that afternoon, without question or doubt, stank to high heaven. Afterward, I lay sick in bed for 3 days straight. It was awful." Her delivery of the story was so dramatic that Ben could not help chuckling. "I'll bet you wish you had that on video." She frowned. And that would be a wager you would lose, she sniffed. Despite the frown, Ben could tell she was enjoying herself immensely. In any case, she continued, I vowed never again to pretend to be someone I was not, and that was a vow I kept. The next time I spoke before a group, my nervousness was even greater, and I told them so. I just want you all to know I am petrified, was my opening line. I hope you enjoy the next 45 minutes. Myself, I'll be closing my eyes. Let me know when it's over. Everyone in the hall laughed. And you know, I could feel the audience rooting for me, reaching out to help me feel at ease. Instead of being merely the audience, they became my partners. Ben laughed out loud. He could easily picture Andel as a younger woman, confessing to her audience and being buoyed by their collective empathy. The point I'm making, Ben, is this. Leadership is not something you can put on and take off like a set of clothes. Your capacity to influence is not something you can rehearse like a speech in a play. People, contrary to popular belief, are not fools. No matter what front you put on, they will read you, consciously or unconsciously, the you behind the words. Hang on, said Ben. Are you saying it doesn't really matter what you say? That there's ultimately no point in choosing your words carefully? Because that sure doesn't sound like you. No, it doesn't. Antel nodded and took a sip of her hot tea. And that's not what I'm saying. It's not that what you say isn't important. It is. That's just not where the source of your power lies. She took another sip as Ben tried to parse the logic of her statement. What you have to give, she continued, you offer least of all through what you say. In greater part, through what you do. But in greatest part, through who you are. Ben's salad came, and he suddenly realized how truly, deeply hungry he was. As he began eating, Aunt Elle said, How are the mother and child? Do we know? Ben nodded and swallowed a bite. They're okay. Actually, that's why I was so late getting here. I wanted to wait and find out if they were going to, you know, find out how they were doing. That could have taken hours, observed Aunt Elle. Yeah, Ben agreed between bites. Actually, it did. A few, anyway. Aunt Elle looked at Ben for a long moment before speaking again. Ben, may I ask you a personal question? She said softly. Ben laughed. You've been doing nothing else all week. I don't see why we'd stop now. Aunt Elle did not smile. No, I mean truly personal. Ben put his fork down. Okay. She paused and said, Have you lost someone? Someone close to you? Ben sat back in his seat, thunderstruck. How did she know? It had been more than a decade since it happened, an illness Ben could barely pronounce, let alone comprehend. It had been so unexpected and so terribly swift. Less than a week it had taken for everything to go from normal to unthinkable. It had been many long months before Ben and Melanie could even manage a conversation about the idea of having another child. All at once, the house had grown still and quiet. The quiet stayed for months, and a year crept by. In time, bit by bit, sounds began to find their way back into Ben and Melanie's home. And then Robbie was born. And before long, almost without Ben realizing it was happening, the house was busy and noisy and full again. But there was a quiet inside of Ben that never left and would never leave. And somehow Aunt Elle had sensed this. He looked at her with amazement. Yes, he nodded slowly. We had a son. He thought for a moment, then added, Ah, Claire must have told you. She shook her head. No, Claire is very good at respecting privacies. Then how? It shows, dear, she said gently. Life leaves a mark. None of us passes through the experience of our days unblemished or pristine. We all suffer tragedies and disappointments, struggles and failures, losses great and small, and every one of them hurts. Life leaves a mark, she repeated, Ben was quiet. Oh, we can try to cover it up, although if we do, we just tend to grow bitter on the inside. Or we can embrace who we are, that is, who we are in the process of becoming. Embrace the hurt, and it deepens you, makes you a richer person. Deny, reject, hold it at bay, fight it off, and it simply hardens you. Either way, it engraves itself onto your soul. She paused to take another sip of hot tea and to let the words sink in. So, she continued, what do you have to offer those people? I'm not sure I know the answer either. I know that competence counts. If you want people to follow you, they need to trust that you know what you're doing. But that's the smaller part of it. They need to trust your competence, yes. But even more, they need to trust your character. Competence is simply the baseline, the thing that puts you in the game. It matters, but honestly, it's a dime a dozen. Character, though, character is that rare, precious gem, and anyone who possesses it is worth a great deal to the world around him. My father used to say, "You can judge someone's character by what he does when no one's watching." I believe that was one of my father's finer utterances. She looked kindly at Ben. I suppose that prompts the question, what creates character? I think perhaps it's the choices you make, how you choose to respond to what life throws at you. Ben was still unable to speak. Andel reached over and placed a strong hand on top of one of his. You can lead only as far as you grow, and you will grow only as far as you let yourself. Yikes, said Ben softly. Yikes indeed, Aunt Ella agreed. A writer I admire once said, I write to find out what I think. Here's what I think, Ben. I think we live to find out who we are. Ben closed his eyes, lost in a swirl of memories and thoughts and feelings. After a moment, he opened his eyes again and said, Were you going to say anything about the word itself? The word? The word character. Andel's face softened with amusement. Now that you mention it. A sip of tea. Character comes from an old Greek word for scrape or scratch. It came to mean an engraved mark and eventually a defining quality. Character is what happens when life scratches itself onto your soul. Claire mentioned that you love words, Ben said. Aunt Elle nodded. That I do, she agreed. Words are the footprints of God. Ben thought for a moment, trying to recall their earlier conversation. Hang on, though. I thought you said words were the greatest human invention ever. Aunt Elle pushed her glasses up on her nose and peered through them at him. That too. Ben did not write in his notebook before going to bed that night. He was too wrapped up in his thoughts. He fell into a troubled sleep in which images from his hospital visit that morning and from other hospital visits long ago pulled at him and refused to let him rest. Finally, in the darkest hours of the night, he slipped quietly from the bed, taking care not to wake Melanie, and padded to his study, where he opened his manifesto and added another page of writing. Stand for something. Lead with your soul. What you have to give, you offer least of all through what you say, in greater part through what you do, but in greatest part through who you are. Competence matters. Character matters more. Character is what happens when life scratches itself onto your soul. You can lead only as far as you grow. And you will grow only as far as you let yourself.
Chapter 11. Robbie. Saturday morning, Ben awoke with a renewed sense of urgency. The board meeting showdown was just 2 days away. As he shaved and showered, he determined to put aside all thoughts of Aunt Elle, their lunchtime conversations about influence, and his keys to legendary leadership. It was time to get down to business. After breakfast, he dove into his research with a vengeance. For hours, he pored through stacks of papers on Allen and Augustine, annual reports, marketing studies, cost-benefit analyses, and more. He felt he had struck out with all four of the company's executives and was no closer to securing their vote than he had been at the beginning of the week. Further, if anything. But it wasn't over. Not by a long shot. He hadn't gotten that reputation as one who ran hard and did his homework by sitting back and admitting defeat. He felt sure this merger would be in Allen and Augustine's best interests. And if it took him all weekend, he was going to assemble the data to prove it. Come Monday evening, he would be ready. He was going to take charge of that boardroom and take home the trophy. Early that afternoon, Mel appeared at the door of the study. "Ben," she said. He looked up. "Hmm? You want me to drive Robbie?" she said. "Drive Robbie where?" And then he remembered. "Of course, Saturday afternoon, the tournament." "It's okay," she said. "You should stay here." "No, no, I'll do it," said Ben, getting up from his chair and stretching out his back. "I promised." When Ben and Robbie reached the big gymnasium, they joined Robbie's teammates, who were assembling in one corner around their young instructor, Kim. Kim congratulated Robbie on his black belt, and all the other kids applauded. Ben felt himself swell up with pride. His son, a black belt, with honors. Kim invited Robbie and another boy to come up in front of the group for a brief sparring demonstration. The other boy was a head taller than Robbie and, from the looks of him, a good 15 pounds heavier. Robbie put him gracefully on the floor inside 30 seconds. Ben was impressed and intrigued. It reminded him of his own confrontation with the big man at the cafe on Wednesday. Only in that encounter, it had been Aunt Elle, not Ben, who disarmed the bigger man. Kim gathered the kids round for a pre-tournament pep talk. Ben had never really listened to these talks. On the relatively rare occasions when he was able to attend one of Robbie's events, 9 times out of 10 Ben would be at work and it was Mel on tourney duty, he would typically be mingling with the other parents as they settled into the stands to watch. Today, though, he felt curious to hear what the young instructor had to say. "Before we begin the tournament," Kim began, addressing the several dozen boys and girls on the mats before him, "we need to ground ourselves in the four pillars of our dojo." Without further prompting, the kids went silent. "Pillar 1, mind. The battle is over before either of you lands the first blow. It is waged first and foremost in your mind. See the entire sequence unfold in your mind's eye before you make the first move. See the other contestant on the floor, subdued and unhurt. The only question is how you can best help to put him there. Pillar 2, connection. It is possible to fight a good match only when you join with the person you are fighting. Rather than seeing your sparring partner as an opponent to be beaten, regard him as a collaborator, working together with you toward a shared conclusion. When you put him on the map, it is not that you have vanquished him, but that you have used his force and trajectory, together with your own, to bring about a harmonious resolution in which both of you emerge unhurt. You have triumphed and won the match, but it is a win that honors you both." Ben was impressed that the kids were all, each one of them, in rapt attention, focusing on Kim's every word. Pillar 3. Flow. Don't overthink. See the match in your mind, but once you are in motion, let go and trust your training. Trust your instincts. Don't try to control the sequence of events. Let it unfold. Ben suddenly felt a tug of familiarity. Trust your instincts. Hadn't Frank said something just like that? Or was it Claire? Or both? Pillar 4, continued Kim. Honor. The bow you make to each other before your match is not an empty gesture, and is far more than mere tradition. Your form, your skill, your execution, these are all important. But more important than any of these is your being. By this we mean your sense of respect, as well as self-worth, of dignity and character. How you behave toward yourself, your opponent, your team, and your dojo. Mind. Connection. Flow. Honor. Now, go and fight a good match. Mind. Connection. Flow. Honor. Ben was stunned, The parallels were impossible to miss. What the young instructor had just described as the four pillars of his martial art sounded uncannily like what Ben had been writing in the little notebook Mel had given him. For the next 2 hours, even as he watched the tournament unfold, he found himself walking through a mental review of the past week's encounters. Robbie had an excellent afternoon, winning 3 of his 4 matches. "Great job, buddy," said Ben as they drove home. "Thanks, Dad." Robbie's reply seemed a little lackluster, and Ben shot him a sideways glance. "You okay?"
"Yeah, I'm good."
Ben wondered whether Robbie had gotten hurt during one of the matches, or if maybe he was coming down with something. "You sure?"
"Dad, I'm good," Robbie grinned. "I'm awesome."
Ben smiled as he drove on. His son had kicked some serious butt today. Sunday morning, Ben attacked the rest of his stack of papers. As on the day before, lunch was a sandwich that by 1 o'clock lay half-eaten on a plate perched on the corner of the little desk. By mid-afternoon, he felt bleary-eyed and overwhelmed. "Hey, Mel," he said after hunting her down in the backyard herb garden, "let's get out of here."
"What are you talking about?"
"Let's go downtown. Let's go walk." "Are you sure you have time for this?" she said. "You've got a big day tomorrow." Ben shrugged. "I'm getting cross-eyed. Robbie's at practice for another 3 hours, and he's got a ride home. Let's go." They drove into town, parked, and took a long walk by the river that ran through the center of the city. Ben remembered bringing Robbie here when he was little to play in a nearby park. They hadn't been here in ages. For more than an hour, the two strolled hand in hand, just walking and talking. Ben loved talking with Melanie. Most often, she just listened to whatever was on his mind. But on those occasions when they had a good stretch of time alone together, time to really talk, she would open up, pouring out her thoughts and feelings on 12 different topics, and it would be Ben who would do the lion's share of the listening. Eventually, it was time to go home. As they wound their way back toward the car, Mel lapsed into silence. Ben knew this look. She was mulling something over.
"What?"
said Ben.
I didn't want to bother you with this, especially with, you know, everything."
"Bother me with what?" She stopped walking, so he did the same. She faced him. "Robbie wants to quit the team."
"What?"
"He wants out of martial arts."
"He what? Are you serious?"
Ben stood stock still for a moment, then realized that Melanie had started walking again and raced to catch up with her. "But," his mind reeled, trying to grasp what she'd said,
"why didn't he tell me?"
"He didn't want to disappoint you."
"But, I don't understand, Mel. Help me out here. Why would he want to quit? He's so good at this. And he loves it. He's worked years to get his black belt. This is what he wanted."
Melanie stopped walking and faced him once more.
"Sweetheart?"
"What?" said Ben. "This has been great for him," she began gently. "It's given him all kinds of confidence. I wouldn't wish it away in 1,000,000 years. But I'm not so sure..." She took both his hands and looked him in the face. "I'm not so sure it really is what he wanted. Maybe it's what you wanted him to want." Ben was dumbfounded. This had never occurred to him, not once. They continued walking in silence for a minute. Then Melanie spoke up again. "He thinks maybe he wants to be a chef." Ben said nothing as he absorbed this last piece of news. As they walked on together, he thought, "He's my own son. How did I not know this?" That night, Ben went into Robbie's room to say goodnight. "Lights out, buddy. School day tomorrow." He stopped and gave Robbie a kiss.
"Night, Dad," said Robbie.
"Good night, Robbie. Great tournament yesterday." He switched off the light and went to the door, then stopped and turned back to face the darkened room.
"Robbie?"
"Yeah?"
"Your mom says you're thinking maybe you want to quit the team."
Silence for a moment.
"She told you that?"
"Yeah, she said you're thinking maybe you want to learn to be a chef." Another silence, this one longer than the first.
"Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know."
As his eyes adjusted, Ben could see Robbie lying on his back, staring at the ceiling.
"You'd be a great chef, Robbie."
"Thanks, Dad, but I don't know. I'm just a kid." "If anyone can do it, you can," said Ben softly. "You're one of the most creative people I know.
Robbie looked over at him with surprise. You really think so, Dad?
Ben shook his head slowly. I don't think so, Robbie. I know so.
Robbie turned over on his side, smiled, and went to sleep.
Chapter 12. Chaos. On Monday, Ben had no appointments with anyone in particular at Allen and Augustine. Instead, he planned to spend the morning walking the floor, talking with some of the employees he had met the week before, and meeting others for the first time. His idea was this. He would get to know as many employees as he could, engaging them in conversations about how the company was doing and what each one thought it most needed to get through these tough times. He wouldn't be making his own case for the merger, at least not overtly. Subtle, after all, could be effective. That was his plan, but it wasn't what happened. Once he was with the people at Allen and Augustine, face to face, his strategy seemed to go out the window. Instead, he found himself simply listening while they told him about their particular roles at the company, about what they did each day, about life at Allen and Augustine, and, to a surprising extent, about their lives in general. He went into each conversation with the renewed intention of sparking a dialogue about what the company needed and planting the seed of his own viewpoint. But within the first 5 minutes, he would become so engaged in the discussion that he would completely forget his purpose for being there. He started with the young man in production, whom he'd seen Frank coaching on the fine points of woodwork detail. From production, he went to visit people in repair on the second floor, and then on through every floor and every department, eventually ending up on the top floor, where, along with Allen's office, the offices of legal and accounting were located. There, while talking with a young man on the company's in-house counsel team about the adorable litter of abandoned puppies the man's son had recently adopted, Ben had read about this the previous week in a caption on those photo gallery walls on 2, he noticed a knot of several employees huddled together on the far side of the office, speaking in quiet voices and glancing occasionally in his direction. After a few minutes, one of them, a woman in her 20s, approached him. She stopped a few feet away and waited until he had finished his conversation with the young lawyer before speaking to him. You're the guy from Martin?
Yes, I'm Ben.
You the one who went to the hospital Friday?
Yes. You must be Phoebe?
The young woman nodded.
They said you sat with her for, like, an hour.
It was actually closer to 2, but Ben just nodded and asked, How is she doing? Phoebe looked away, then back at Ben.
She passed. That night.
She managed to smile.
Anyway, I just wanted to thank you.
Ben realized she was holding out her hand to shake. He took her hand with both of his.
I'm so sorry.
At lunchtime, he left the building and walked briskly down the block toward the cafe. Today he was especially eager to meet with Aunt Elle. It would be the last chance he'd have to talk with her before the big board meeting that evening, and he very much wanted to get her take on the approach he had developed for his speech. When Sal ushered him to the corner table that had begun to feel like home, he found it empty. He was the first one there.
Good.
He could use a few minutes alone. He ordered a hot coffee, then began going over what he wanted to talk about with Aunt Elle. He took out a business card, placed it on the table face down, and withdrew a pen from his jacket pocket. The day before, he hadn't been able to put the 4 pillars of Robbie's dojo out of his mind. Clearly, Kim's formula was working for those boys. The way Robbie had taken charge of the match and taken that big guy down was amazing. And that was exactly what Ben needed to do in that boardroom tonight. He had spent a considerable chunk of the evening before looking over his jotted thoughts in his Ben's Manifesto notebook and thinking about everything Claire and Aunt Elle had said about influence during their lunches together. Before going to sleep, he had done his best to boil it all down into 4 words, which he now wrote down carefully on the back of the business card. Vision. Empathy. Grounding. soul. This, in extremely abbreviated form, was the outline of the speech he would give that evening. A waiter Ben did not recognize came by to see if he wanted to order. "Thank you so much," replied Ben. "I appreciate it. I'd like to hold off for a bit, though, if that's okay. I'm waiting for someone to join me."
"Tutto bene," said the waiter softly, and quickly disappeared.
Ben turned his attention back to his mini-outline and began reviewing his speech in his mind. First, he would paint a picture of Alan and Augustine's story, from its churchyard days to its stunning ascendancy, through its current troubled times, and on into the chapter that lay ahead, the exciting recapture of its former glory. Vision. Next, he would put a human face on that vision, sharing a few stories of individuals at another company that had struggled before being acquired by Marden, and how the shot in the arm that merger provided had subsequently changed their lives. Empathy. Then came the grounding section, and this was where his homework would pay off in spades. He had done the work all right. The transformation he was sketching out was a tall order, but he had the facts to back it up and lock it down. The Marden Group clearly showed enormous strength in exactly those areas where Alan and Augustine had been most lacking. And finally, soul. He would conclude with an impassioned discourse on how personally committed he was to seeing the merger work out in the best interests of all involved, and how he, Ben, would not rest until that had happened to everyone's satisfaction. The waiter came by again. Did the gentleman wish to order perhaps an appetizer while he waited? Ben chose an item from the menu, and the waiter vanished again. Ben pulled a sheaf of folded papers from his jacket pocket, his speech notes. He figured he could afford to review them once again while he waited. He reviewed, and waited, and reviewed, and waited. Claire and Aunt Elle did not appear. Strangely, the more he went over his notes, the less certain he felt about them. He glanced again at his little back-of-the-business card word chart. It looked very symmetrical, clear, and logical. His appetizer came, and he ate without tasting it. An hour had gone by. They weren't coming. He paid his bill, stood up, and left the restaurant. But instead of walking back toward the Alan and Augustine building, he began walking in the opposite direction, with no clear idea of where he was heading. As he walked, he tried to put his finger on what was bothering him, but the more he tried, the more his thoughts felt like chaos. He walked and walked, his path taking him past all the city's most famous landmarks. He walked past the Liberty Building, in the heart of the financial district, the tallest building in the city, without even glancing up. He walked past the city's sprawling auditorium, where famous speakers gave talks to packed crowds. He circled back through the old garment district, past the offices of Rachel's Famous Coffee and the foundation where Claire worked, a squat little five-story refurbished factory perched amid a gentrified landscape of boutique grocery markets and loft apartments. Ben kept walking and eventually ended up by the river where he and Melanie had strolled the day before. All he could think about was Aunt Elle's question. What do you really have to offer them? He had the vague sense that there was something beyond the 4 points he had listed on his business card, something important, but he could not identify what it might be. It all makes sense, he said out loud to no one but himself. Leaders hold a vision. Leaders care about their people. Leaders get their hands dirty and their boots muddy, do the work and make the tough decisions. And leaders stand for something. It's about all those things. But, he stopped walking, but at the same time somehow it wasn't about any of those things. He looked around at where he stood. His walk had taken him to the little park by the river where he and Mel used to bring Robbie to play. His legs seemed to have brought him here on their own. He now found himself in the park center, facing a statue of an elephant, surrounded by 4 blind men all touching different parts of the animal. He knew the story. Each of the 4 would describe the nature of the beast based on what he could feel of it. 1 felt a leg, the 2nd the tail, the 3rd the beast's trunk, and the 4th a tusk. And not surprisingly, they each concluded it was a completely different thing. The statue had been commissioned and placed there years ago by the city fathers. As he thought about it, it seemed to Ben he remembered hearing that Pindar himself had had something to do with this. To remind the city's inhabitants that when people held very different viewpoints on the same topic, chances were excellent that no one position was wholly right, nor wholly wrong. The thought brought to mind a comment Karen had made a few days earlier. "They're good guys," she had said, speaking of Alan, Augustine, and Frank. "And they all see important aspects of the business." Aspects. He supposed that was exactly what those four blind men were seeing. Aspects of the elephant. But wasn't an elephant far more than the sum of its aspects? Ben thought about that. So, what was he missing? Aunt El had asked him what he had to offer the company. What was the whole elephant? What did Alan and Augustine need? Suddenly Ben heard an odd sound, like a subdued chorus of oboes in the distance, or perhaps English horns. He looked to the left and to the right, but saw nothing. Then he glanced upward and saw a long, slender V slipping gently across the autumn sky. Canada geese, arrowing their way southward as the fall cooled. "Time to head for warmer climes," he murmured. He recalled reading somewhere that the V formation gave the birds far greater aerodynamic efficiency, allowing them to travel great distances without tiring. As he watched, the flock's formation blurred and shifted direction, breaking apart and reforming seamlessly with a different bird slipping into point position at the V's apex. Ben marveled. How did they know how to do that? The gentle honking continued, gradually fading as the birds made for the horizon. It seemed to Ben the most beautiful sound he had ever heard. At that moment, the city's clock tower tolled six, and Ben realized with a start that he'd better get going. He had a speech to give.
Chapter 13. The Speech. "Alan and Augustine has fallen on hard times." The slender man perched at the podium paused, and the sound system let out a crackle. As the weight of his first eight words sank in, the 500-plus people thronged in their seats held their collective breath, waiting to see what he would say next. For all his gentle, unassuming manner, Alan was clearly capable of commandeering a lectern and holding a crowd's attention. The man knew how to take charge. Ben was impressed. "Let's face facts," Alan continued. "The last 3 years have been brutal. You know it, we know it, and the bean counters at the Martin Group know it. The salient question is, where do we go from here?" He went on to paint an inspiring portrait of the company's future, a vision of new generations of the city's leaders being raised and educated in Alan and Augustine chairs. He reviewed the epic gains they had made, the innovations others had at first ridiculed and then come to imitate, their civic and social impact in their community, as well as their commercial successes. Their current travails were cyclic, he added, not terminal. They had been through tight squeezes before and prevailed, and if nothing else, the sheer weight of history declared that they would do so again. It was stirring, the quintessential view out the top floor plate glass wall. Yet for all Alan's eloquence, Ben sensed, to his surprise, that the congregation was not entirely uplifted. They were inspired by their leader's prose and devoted to his person, but they weren't buying it. Not entirely. Next, Augustine lumbered to the podium, paused, and looked out at the room with an expression both sober and radiant. Just as Ben had expected they would, his first eight words evoked a stark contrast to the mood of Alan's. "What can I say? I love you guys." The room erupted in applause. "And what's more important, I believe in you guys." More applause. He continued on in that vein, giving an impassioned homily on the subject of how much he believed in the people of Alan and Augustine, the miles they had traveled together as a family, and the many untraveled miles that lay ahead still. As Augustine spoke, Ben noticed something he had not expected. Despite the obviously deep and genuine fondness everyone there had for the man, they were not altogether in sync with his message, any more than they had been with Alan's. Something was off. There was a sense of nervous uncertainty in the air. Ben noticed Karen sitting in the last row, watching the proceedings, her expression unreadable as ever. More speakers followed, mostly expressing their undying devotion to the company and, not so subtly, their view that the merger would be a mistake. A company lawyer, the same young man whose son had just adopted that litter of abandoned puppies, reviewed their options from both legal and personal standpoints. A representative of one of their top suppliers, who introduced himself, to much applause, as a devoted second-generation Alan and Augustine customer, told a charming story about his mother rocking to sleep her grandson, his own infant son, in an Alan and Augustine chair just the night before. Yet Ben heard barely a word of it. As speaker followed speaker, he found himself unable to focus on what they were saying, riveted instead on what felt like the unspoken mood of the audience. There was an aura of vulnerability in the room. He began to sense that, if one were to push on them, the people here might well yield and move in the direction of the push. That, perhaps, the reins in this meeting were his for the taking. He felt a palpable crackle of electricity in his hands. It was raw power. In that moment, he knew that when it came his turn to speak, if he chose his words well, and in his meticulously prepared sheaf of notes, he knew he had chosen them quite well indeed, he could very likely sway these 500 people, manipulate their mood, mold them like clay. The Ben of a week ago would be feeling an anticipatory flush of triumph. And the Ben of right now? He wasn't quite sure just what he was feeling. The last person to speak was Frank. Standing at the lectern, the big man gave the distinct impression that he would rather be anywhere other than standing on a stage, but that he was here to do what needed doing. He spoke briefly and without notes. "Look," he began, "you know where I stand. This is the greatest company on the face of the earth. If it weren't for these two guys, none of us would be here. A lot of us probably wouldn't even have jobs. Or anyways, not jobs we love. We're all part of something great here. Let's not screw it up." He left the stage to the loudest applause of the evening. Finally, now it was Ben's turn to speak. He climbed the three steps to the stage, turned, spread his notes out on the lectern, then looked out into the 500 faces gathered before him. "Well," he paused, momentarily startled by how the sound system amplified and distorted his voice. He glanced down to the end of the first row where, off to the side, sat Thomas J. Bushnell himself. By special arrangement, Ben's boss had been granted permission to attend the meeting as an observer only and would not be addressing the group. Their eyes met briefly and the message was unmistakable. It was all up to Ben now. "I met last week with your leaders," he began. "With Alan and Augustine and Frank and Karen. I heard what they had to say. I listened to your leadership again just now. And you know, they make a good point." He paused. "Take charge, Ben," he told himself. "Take control." He looked around the conference room. "Take the reins. Take command. Take, take, take." Was that really what he was here to do? Ben looked down at his notes. They might as well have been in Sanskrit. With a queasy sense, almost like an attack of vertigo, he recognized that his carefully prepared speech, much like his carefully planned conversations with the employees that morning, had somehow, for some reason he couldn't begin to fathom, just flown out the window. He looked up again at the people. "Yes," Ben nodded slowly and then added, speaking quietly as if to himself, "yes, they make a very good point." There was silence for a moment. Frank shared a skeptical glance with the person sitting next to him. "Here comes the but," said Frank in a stage whisper. But, this time, there was no but. "As you all know, I represent the Marden Group. We have tendered an offer to buy your company. You guys are in a bind,
and we have the resources to get you out of it. My job is to persuade you that we won't wreck your company in the process." He paused again. "A week ago, I came here on a mission to take you by storm, to convert you, convince you, if necessary to steamroll you, to dazzle you. But you dazzled me." As Ben heard himself say these words, he realized that they were true. "You are amazing. Do you know how amazing you are? I've watched you for a week now. The way you look out for each other, care for each other. The way you treat your business, your customers, your community. The purpose, the devotion and richness you bring to each task at hand. You're not just building chairs. You're building life." Ben felt his voice catch. The intensity of his feelings caught him by surprise. "When I got here, I thought your slogan was hokey. We hold you up. I was wrong. It's not hokey. It's the simple truth. In a lot of companies, when they face tough times, what do you see? More backbiting, more internal politics, more people circling their wagons to protect and defend their own turf. Not you. You don't do that. You hold each other up. I told many of you this week that I wanted to see you recapture your former glory. I had that all wrong, too. There's nothing former about it. You are as glorious today, right now, as you ever were." He flashed on the case notes he had so carefully researched, the argument advanced in the pages that now lay ignored on the lectern. It was a good argument, and it all seemed solid, powerful, of genuine value. "But it's all me, me, me," he thought. "Would you lay down your life for this company?" Karen had asked. Maybe not, but he was prepared to lay down his livelihood if it came to that. The clarity of the thought startled him, but it was true. To see Alan and Augustine succeed on their own terms, without even the subtlest intimidation or manipulation, he was willing to give up his job. Ben took a deep breath and let it out. "Someone I respect very much asked me a question that has plagued me all week. What do I really have to offer you? What does the Martin Group have that you need? I've been thinking about that, and I think I know the answer." He looked around the room. "Here goes." "Nothing," he said. "There's nothing we have that you need. Not really. A cash infusion, distribution clout, market leverage. Sure, maybe. But there's nothing we have to offer that adds to who you truly are." Without looking, he could feel Bushnell's eyes searing into him. "Oh, I have ideas. Even pretty good ones." He held up his sheaf of notes and waved it vaguely. "I mean, I think this merger is a good idea. I really do." He gave a thin smile, then added, "But." To his shock, a ripple of quiet laughter whispered through the room. He didn't know quite what to make of that and couldn't let himself stop to think about it now. "And," he went on, "all that is my idea. Of course, we have money, that's true. And as someone pointed out to me a few days ago, money is the lifeblood of an organization. Money is where it all gets real. I wonder, though, if that's entirely true. Some of you remember standing in a burned-out churchyard, penniless. And you remember what happened next. It seems to me money doesn't build companies. Companies build money." Ben paused and thought. "You don't need us, at least not critically. And I'm not at all sure you want us. I could try to paint a picture for you of how our two companies could work together for the benefit of both. But I don't have Alan's vision or Augustine's big heart. And I'll never have even half as much hands-on knowledge about how your business actually works as Frank has in his big toe." He glanced up and noticed Karen in her back row seat, squinting at him with a puzzled frown. "I could tell you all about who I am and what I stand for, what I see as the future of this company. But that's all just me, me, me. And this isn't about me or about Martin. It's about you." He looked around the room, carefully avoiding eye contact with Bushnell. "I came here with a job to do, to get you to say yes. I'm sorry to say I've failed. And it's not just that I failed to persuade you. Truth is, I can't even say for sure whether I believe you should say yes. In any case, it's your decision, and you're the ones I'd trust to make it. He started to leave the dais, then had a sudden thought and stepped back to the mic once more. You know that question I mentioned, the one that's been dogging me for a solid week now? What do I really have to offer you? It occurs to me that I just found the answer. Ladies and gentlemen, I offer you, you. The room was quiet. Ben gathered up his unused notes, left the dais, and walked to the back of the hall, through the exit, and out into the night.
Chapter 14. Giving Leadership.
You can go right in, said Thomas J. Bushnell's secretary. He's expecting you.
I'll bet he is, thought Ben.
When he had reported to work at the Marden Group headquarters that morning, he was told that Mr. Bushnell wanted to see him right away. And now, here he was, standing in front of the boss's door, his hand on the knob, trying to get up the courage to enter the lion's den. He slipped one hand into his jacket pocket to touch the piece of folded paper there. He was pretty sure he was about to be demoted back to sales at best, or far more likely dismissed from the Marden Group altogether, possibly after a sound tongue-lashing that he hoped would not be too humiliating. Talking it over with Mel very late the night before, after that calamitous board meeting, he had decided that, rather than be fired, he would offer his resignation. That was the letter in his jacket pocket. He steeled himself, turned the knob, pushed open the door, and entered. There was no one at the big desk. Looking off to the right, he saw the backs of three chairs drawn around the fireplace at the far end of the spacious office. One chair was empty. In a second sat Bushnell himself, and in the third, an elderly woman who turned as Ben approached. And now Ben realized at last why it was that Claire's lunchtime companion had looked vaguely familiar to him when they'd first met the week before. It was a family resemblance. Only it was not Claire she resembled, but his own boss, Thomas J. Bushnell. Her son. Andrew Marden, the founder and patriarch of the Marden Group, had passed the company on to his daughter, Elizabeth Bushnell, née Marden. Aunt L? Ah, Ben, please join us. Ben stood riveted in place just inside the office door, his mind as frozen as his feet. Elizabeth. L. How had Claire put it? In her day, she was a very successful businesswoman.
You just put one foot in front of the other, Aunt L said, and in no time at all, you'll be right over here with us.
Ben's mind was still reeling. What? He said dumbly, then realized what she had said. Oh, right. He made his feet walk over to where the two sat, and stood by Andel's chair.
Why didn't you tell me who you were?
Would knowing have helped you any? She said. Ben thought about it. No, he realized. If he had known who it was he was chatting with all week, he probably would have been so nervous he wouldn't have been able to hold any kind of intelligent conversation at all. Anyway, she continued, I didn't know who you were either, not at first. And I generally try to stay out of Thomas's business. I'm an old lady now, with her own affairs to attend to. Besides, she added, it wasn't about me. It was about you. Ben thought about that for a moment. The less you say, he ventured, the more influence you have. Aunt L pursed her lips and inclined her head an inch. Touché. Ben was still grappling with the revelation of Aunt L's identity, his mind frantically rewinding through their conversations of the past week, and trying to sift through the implications and layers of meaning now that he knew who she truly was. Her stories about her father, old man Marden himself, about her son, the boxer, his boss, her business experiences. But there wasn't time to sort it all out. He wasn't here for a reunion.
He was here to face the music. He turned toward the other occupied chair.
Sir, I'm so sorry I wasn't able—
I know, said Bushnell. Here's the thing, and please, sit. You make me nervous standing there.
Bushnell tweaked his head in the direction of the empty chair on the other side of Aunt El.
Ben sat, and was stunned by the familiar, otherworldly sensation. This felt exactly like the chair he had sat on in Alan's office. No, wait. It was that chair. What was it doing here?
But there was no time to think that through either. Bushnell was speaking. We were never going to go in there with massive layoffs, you know, break their company up into pieces, dismantle what they'd built. Alan and Augustine is a treasure. We only wanted to give them the ground and the space to grow. And we'd told both Alan and Augustine that. But we couldn't get them to believe it. We were the big bad Marden Group. We couldn't get them to trust us. In short, we could not get them to agree to a merger.
Silence hung heavy in the room. Ben slipped a hand into his jacket pocket and grasped hold of his letter of resignation. This was probably as good a time as any.
Apparently, Bushnell continued, the one person who could accomplish that was you.
Ben's hand froze.
Sir? We had a visit last night, here in the office, after the board meeting. A visit from Alan and Augustine. At the meeting they told us, when you said, this isn't about me, it made them think. They wanted to come over and talk. They were here for 2 hours. They said they finally realized what the real problem was over there. They saw what had been holding Alan and Augustine back.
Really?
Ben was so intrigued at this, he forgot to say, Sir, or Mr. Bushnell.
Which was what?
Bushnell looked at Ben. Alan. And Augustine.
It took Ben a moment to realize that Bushnell had not simply repeated the company's name. He was saying that the two brothers had identified themselves as being the prime barrier to progress at their own company.
Ben slowly shook his head. I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Here, said Anto, let me show you something.
She turned toward her son and said, Do you have anything I might write on, Thomas?
He produced a small pad of paper and a pen and handed them to her.
She took the pad and wrote a few letters on it. L-E-A-D. Then she drew two curved arrows indicating that the L and the D were changing places.
Underneath, she now wrote the new word that this change produced. D, E, A, L.
This is what happens to so many leaders and people of influence. Kings, presidents, heads of religious organizations and great corporations. It can happen to anyone with a following of any size or number. After a time, they start getting it backwards. They absorb all that trust and faith, the sense of all those people looking to them for guidance, inspiration, and constancy, and they confuse the container with the contents. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Ben was not sure he did.
As a leader, you become the container of others' hopes. When we say people put their trust in you, that is exactly what happens. They place their hopes and dreams, trust and faith, even their fears, into your hands, because these things feel too fragile, too big, too important, too valuable to hold onto by themselves. You become the trustee of their intangibles.
Ben felt the gentle curve of maple spindles at his back. Like a good chair, he ventured.
Aunt El gave another of her faint sphinx almost smiles. Exactly. Like a good chair. You hold them, believe in them, when they forget how to believe in themselves. But, she added.
Ben looked at her sharply. Did she know about his verbal hand grenades?
Knowing her, she probably did. She was having him on. But, she repeated, you are not their dreams. You are only the steward of those dreams. And leaders too often get it backwards and start thinking they not only hold the best of others,
but that they are that best. They start thinking they are the deal. And the moment you begin thinking that it's all about you, that you're the deal, is the moment